Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This week, we're getting a jump on both Mardi Gras and Chinese New Year. First, with a visit from Lost Bayou Rambler Louis Michaud and Bayou Teche brewer Carlos Knott, who'll give us the lowdown on the Cajun celebration, the Courier de Mardi Gras. They've been brewing up some new beers in Arnoville, perfect for Mardi Gras and for our upcoming crawfish season. Then, former AP correspondent Audra Ang shares an intimate look at life in mainland China as revealed in her new book, To the People, Food is Heaven. It's time to get the party started on this week's Louisiana Eats. Carlos Knott is brewmaster at Bayou Teche Brewing. Louis Michaud is the legendary leader of the Lost Bayou Ramblers. Together, they've been collaborating on both fronts, brewing up a lot more than just beer. Carlos and Louis, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy. So glad to be back.
So the two of you all just released a new CD in collaboration, of course, with Bayou Teche, and it's a follow-up to last year's En Francais. Tell us about that.
Well, we actually, at Lost Bayou Ramblers, had gotten LA 31 to donate some beer to our Mammoth Waltz recording. And that's how we kind of started with the idea, was the beer and music already. You know, we came with this idea to do very classic rock and roll tunes in Cajun and Creole French by local bands. And the first one did so well, Carlos and the brewer decided to do a second one and asked me to produce it again, and I was more than honored to do it. We got a whole new round of bands, some amazing diversity from young sisters, the Babineau sisters, to like the classic Beausoleil and Terrence Simeon Grammy winners. Actually, a brass band from Opelousas called Soul Express Brass Band featuring Corey Ledet on the accordion, amazing pair. So,
well, I know that the purpose of that, which I thought was so brilliant, was to sing old rock and roll songs in Cajun French, so it would help people learn the language that concerns you could be in danger of being lost. So I remember some of the selections from the first CD. I thought Iron Man was pretty hilarious. That made me laugh. What's on the second one?
Yeah, that's right. We got that same band that did Iron Man does When the Levee Breaks, a very appropriate song. The Babineau sisters did their own version of The Watchtower, La Tour de Garde.
And who are the Babineau sisters?
Babineau sisters, they're 12 and 14. They might be a year older each now, but they're just an amazingly talented family. It's two sisters, and they have a whole band. They play accordion, fiddle, and guitar, switch off. And they took Watchtower, and they took Three Little Birds from Bob Marley. That's the beauty of this project. They own it. You know, it's like they wrote the song in Cajun French already. And, you know, you might think Bob Dylan had heard it from them. But no, it's really that's an overstatement. But it really is amazing. And like you said, it's really to help all of the people in South Louisiana or anywhere that want to learn Cajun and Creole French to learn it through words they already know, like All Along the Watchtower.
And the nice thing about this CD was a little different. It has more of a generational feel because many of the bands had kids, their parents, grandparents, all in the studio together. Terrence Simeon and his daughter sang together,
yeah,
and the Barrars, it was the whole family. And it gave kind of a different groove to the whole CD, I think.
Well, that's the beauty of Cajun country, right? There's nothing more important than family over there.
Family and food.
That's true. Well, speaking of food, let's transition right into beer. For goodness sake, let's talk about some beer. I understand you've got a Mardi Gras beer brewing?
We sure do. It's an annual release of ours called Courier de Mardi Gras. Our Mardi Gras in our part of Louisiana is much different than over here in New Orleans. And we wanted to celebrate that ancient tradition, that Courier de Mardi Gras, with a French-style beer. It's a Bière de Mars, which is a March beer in English. And
Mardi Gras is a little early, so I guess we're just jumping on the March beer a little
early. Well, you know, sometimes we get it in March. So. But in France, it's a style of beer that's brewed in farmhouses. And it's usually brewed at the end of the last season. So it's all the freshest crop of all the barley and the hops. And they'd put it away for the winter and break it out in March. And it's usually a pretty strong beer, I guess, as well. So this beer for us is all imported French barley and hops. And it's about a 7.5% alcohol. It's a smooth beer, so it'll sneak up on you as well. We expect to see some of the riders this year fall off their horses.
Tell us a little bit about what that Mardi Gras experience is like over there in Cajun country. How do y'all celebrate?
I guess I can tell you how we did it growing up, and then Louis can probably tell you about the history of it more than I can. But my grandparents grew up in a little small town called Bayou Portage. Portage is like to carry your boat across the water, which is how narrow this bayou is. You can literally walk across it. They would do the career in those days. It was all these men would dress up in these real gaudy handmade costumes, and they'd cut up in French and scream and holler and till you gave them something, and then they'd leave the house.
And like an onion or a...
The prize was a chicken. They'd throw a live chicken out, and people would chase it. They'd get on their horses. Of course, they were all tissoulé, a little drunk.
Uh-huh.
And some of them would fall off their horses. But they'd cut up to give them an ingredient for the gumbo, and at the end of the day, they made a big pot, and everybody would show up, and there was French music. It's really nice. It was kind of like utopia, almost. Everybody got together, and there was potato salad and desserts. It was just a blast.
And how about you, Louis? How do you celebrate Mardi Gras?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I do, too.
Still.
Yeah, that's there's definitely a bunch of couriers still happening. There's Church Point, Mamou, Lance Meg, Lance Lejeune. That goes on and on. But either way, it's definitely about getting together and not hiding behind the mask, but just being somebody else for the day and letting yourself go. And like, you know, all the small towns where a lot of these happen, the social restrictions just out the water, you know, because in small towns, you know how it is socially.
Yeah.
Well, now, you know, it's your one day to just completely let loose and anything goes on that day, really. And that's when it's your chance to go heckle your neighbors and they don't know who you are. So you get it all out on that day, you know. And then if you're lucky, you don't get whipped too bad. The whipping can be part of the traditional,
whipping.
You know, a real pelt, you know, you get tanned a little bit.
And each town has its own variation of the Mardi Gras song is the other neat thing. It sounds the same, you know, if you don't know French, but each little town has its own variation. And
how does the song go?
Le Mardi Gras s'en vient de tout partout, le tout moyeu. Ça passe une fois par an, monde la charité. Quand même, c'est si un patat tout dégratant. And then it goes on to say all, you know, that's...
Could you translate for us?
Yeah, the Mardi Gras riders come from everywhere. Le Moyeu is, there's a couple translations of that. It could be the hub or it could be the stump. You know, it's kind of like this thing, toe de Mardi Gras, all around the stump is where the Mardi Gras is. You kind of, you know, go in this little dance in a circle. We come once a year to ask for charity, for donations from the house, even if it's a potato or some gratin.
Uh-huh.
And then it goes on to say, oh, you know, will you accept this band of drunkards? Will you accept this band of Mardi Gras? We only come once a year. That's all we ask.
Oh, that is so wonderful.
Some towns like Mahmoud, I think they live just for that 2 days because there's nothing else going on the rest of the year.
So I understand that you are also working on a special new brew that's specially designed for drinking with crawfish?
That's right, Poppy. It's Saison de Crevice. It's a Belgian-style Saison, which is a farmhouse brew. This one's brewed with rye, and rye in beer is the same thing like rye in bread. It gives that woody kind of spiciness to the beer. And it also has an imported Belgian yeast that throws a peppery flavor in as well. So this beer is a pretty flavorful beer. It's really spicy and flavorful, so it can compete with boiled crawfish. We've also putting it in 22-ounce bottles, so you don't have to make as many trips to the ice chest with your crawfish.
That's a good idea. And it was so lucky, crawfish season's early this year, so you've got something all ready to drink along with it. How did you determine what the flavor profile was going to be?
We kind of worked backwards, and that's how we do a lot of our beers. We know in our mind what we think will work, and so as far as the flavor, and so we have to work backwards with the ingredients. This is a Belgian style, and Belgian beers, and French beers for that matter, are really geared around the saison, or the season. And so you have a lot of latitude with those beers. And for us, it was that idea of we're going to take this saison and change it for different foods. And the first one was a crawfish. We have some other ones down the road with different versions of the saison. So in addition to the rye, which gives that spiciness, we use a lot of wheat because wheat is a refreshing beer. It kind of cleanses the palate, kind of calms the heat as well.
Well, I'm really looking forward to eating some boiled crawfish.
We've also worked with some French growers with this beer, hop growers. And instead of most breweries in America have to just buy their hops through a broker, we're getting them directly from the farm in France.
How'd you find these people?
We met through the En Francais CD. He had ordered one. And then he contacted me. He said he's the seller for a hop farm in France in the Alsace. And then next thing I know, one day, usually when they send you samples, you get like an ounce of hops.
Uh-huh.
Well, I got 3 40-pound bags of French hops.
Wow.
And so those are going in the saison. And then we've contracted with them. Now we're buying many of our hops directly from the farm in France.
That's food and music. Isn't that just the international language?
What an amazing connection. Huh?
That is fantastic. Did you ever think that you'd get hops for a song?
That's a first.
So, Carlos, I want to know what else new is coming down the pike from the brewery this year.
We have another new beer coming out next month in February. It's a variation of our Bière Joie, which is our coffee double. And doubles are a Belgian Trappist style of beer, usually pretty malty and also very high alcohol. We spike it with Mellow Joy coffee. This one we're calling the Lagniappe edition. It's aged in Jack Daniel's barrels for several months, where it picks up a lot of toasted oak and vanilla flavors and some whiskey flavors as well. In that barrel, we're aging it on some vanilla, some cocoa nibs, and some locally grown chili peppers. It sounds like it's really too much Lagniappe, maybe, but it actually works very well. We've been tasting it every week, and it's quite delicious. The Belgians brew a lot of their beers with this candy sugar. They don't make it in America, but basically they caramelize white sugar. It's delicious. So when we brew, you can tell because all the guys are like licking their fingers the whole time, sticking their hands in the bag. The beer's quite tasty, though. It's a complex beer, but it's not so complex it's not approachable and enjoyable.
Well, the last time we talked to you, you were talking about what was then a new beer called Beer Noir, which was inspired by drinking coffee around the table all day and all night like Cajuns do. How does this beer differ from that one?
It's definitely a beer you sip. It's not something you would really want to drink after you've cut the grass.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the Bière Noir, it's a complex beer, but it's still light enough body to where you can go crawfishing or fishing and come back and knock back a few. Matter of fact, when we were brewing it, we buy this malt from France called a coffee roast malt. It's barley that's roasted to look like coffee. Gar Hatcher, our new brewmaster, he's working by himself, and we're all doing some other stuff. Also, he like screams like Dr. Watson, come see you. So we all run to see what's the matter. He goes, taste this malt. And it was barley, but it tasted exactly like French roast coffee.
That's fantastic.
I must say, I had the pleasure of trying some a couple weeks ago, and it was, I didn't even think I was drinking beer. It was like drinking the best cup of coffee I ever had, but it was just an amazing experience. I can't wait to try it myself.
That tasting job, it's a hard job.
Huh? Right out the canister.
We're not drinking, we're working.
Yeah, that's it. And I think it would surprise a lot of people to know that, Louis, when you're not traveling with the Bayou Ramblers, you do a lot of PR and marketing for the brewery. And, you know, I've seen this before. Like, you just stroll right into a bar to talk to them about what beers they've got on tap and behind the bar. Is that a surprise to people when they look up and see it's you?
It's actually been a great balance, I could say. You know, being a musician has its ups and downs. It's very fun. You don't get rich unless, you know, you're like Justin Bieber or something like that. But I started last year, yeah, kind of doing some PR and stuff. And, yeah, walking into places that I've played and that I haven't played, and whether they know me or not, just introducing myself. I really love the product. I love the beer that they're making where I happen to live. I didn't even know. You know, I moved out there, come to find out there's a huge arts renaissance, there's a brewery coming up, and it's just such a great coincidence or, you know, whatever, however you explain these things that happen at the,
kismet,
at the same time.
Kismet, that's one of my favorite words for it. But y'all make such a great team.
I did an interview this morning real early, and they asked, what does Louis do at the brewery? I said, well, he's our ambassador to the United States.
And the world.
And the world.
And the distribution these days. You're really stretching out across the United States, aren't you?
We're all the way currently to Florida and up to Georgia. But we just found out we're getting into New York City. Next month, Louis going up there for us. Louis bringing his fiddle and our other ambassador, Derek Domingue, bringing his spatula. Apparently, a lot of people come to New Orleans from New York for vacations or for work, and they would go back to New York asking for the beer. And a distributor called and said, man, I'm getting calls all the time for LA 31 beer. We struck a deal, so we're going to be up there. I've never been, so we're kind of excited to be up there.
Well, I am so glad y'all traveled over to visit with us and brought us all this delicious news about the brewery. I can't wait for some crawfish beer and some Mardi Gras beer, and I'm just ready. So thanks, guys.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to come talk to you, Poppy.
We have a career costume ready for you in a couple of weeks.
Brewmaster Carlos Knott and Lost Bayou Rambler Louis Michaud. Brewing up some fun at Bayou Teche Brewery. When we come back from a short break, we'll take a trip to China with Audra Ong and learn why, in today's ever-changing Far Eastern landscape, to the people, food is heaven. Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's culinary heritage hero is the author of a favorite Creole cookbook, as well as a civil rights activist. Because of our hero's activism, in 1963, racial segregation in New Orleans restaurants and other public places finally came to an end with a ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case that bears our hero's name. That long march to the highest court in the land began simply by sitting down at the McCrory's Five and Dime lunch counter on Canal Street.
The difference in the situation that we participated in was that the mayor insisted that blacks not be served in those places of public. And as a result, ultimately, the United States Supreme Court said, well, this wasn't an issue of private property, because if the mayor insisted that the local codes be enforced, which were not on the books so much, the fact that he insisted on us being arrested and being denied service made it a case that took it out of the realm of, say, private property and made it a public action.
Our hero's deep personal interest in food and the people who cooked it later led the civil rights activist to co-author with Chef Nathaniel Burton Creole Feast, a 1978 cookbook chronicling the life stories and recipes of 15 black master chefs who created the classic dishes that form the bedrock of New Orleans cuisine, but who, until then, had gone completely unheralded.
Everything that was unique about New Orleans could be traced to the black presence in this city. whether it was music, whether it was carnival, whether it was architecture, and I said, and food. So I could name names of African Americans who were prominent in all these areas of the history and culture of New Orleans. But when I said food, I realized I couldn't name names. I just knew that there were blacks cooking in all of the great restaurants in New Orleans. And so my argument is that the Creole Feast is the first cookbook in America about American chefs.
That's why Rudy Lombard is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Congratulations, Rudy, and thank you for making sure that everyone is welcome at the table when it's time to sit down for some Louisiana Eats. Born Audra Ang worked as Beijing correspondent for the Associated Press from 2002 through 2009. In her new book, To the People, Food is Heaven, Audra shares her intimate view of the China she observed, convulsed in change, spiced with food memories of the ultimate Peking duck and the surprising drunken crabs. Audra, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you so much for having me today, Poppy.
Audra, tell me, why did you call the book To the People, Food is Heaven?
To the People, Food is Heaven is actually a translation of a well-known Chinese saying. And the full saying in Mandarin is, to the emperor, the people are heaven. To the people, food is heaven. And So it's kind of a reflection of, to the emperor, the people were the most important thing, but to the people, food's the most important thing.
So, Audra, in your book, you devote two entire chapters to foods that China is pretty much internationally recognized for, tea and Peking duck. Now, I thought we could start talking about the tea tradition first, because it is said to have roots that go back over 5,000 years in China. Explain the cultural importance of tea.
I always tell people I'm an eater, not a cooker. So a lot of the things, like, I just kind of experienced there, but I really had to do a ton of research while actually writing the book. So to me personally, what I experienced in the non-academic setting is just how pervasive tea is. It's something that's almost always offered to you when you go to someone's home, especially in the villages. But I just felt there were so many facets to tea drinking. It's not just a beverage, but, you know, it's a way for people to make you feel at home. For one thing, I thought, I didn't realize that tea, I mean, the kind of tea I love the best is jasmine tea. I thought there was a jasmine tea plant. That's how ignorant I was. But it's really, you know, it's really the basic green tea leaf, and then you infuse it with the flavors of the jasmine flowers. Things like that I learned through my tea lady, who was absolutely awesome.
When participating in a tea ceremony, would you explain to us the finger tap?
Yes, and that's another thing I loved that I learned when I was there. So when anyone serves you tea, whether it's in someone's home or in a restaurant, you can obviously say thank you. But the way most people do it is you use your index and third finger, I guess. It's kind of like when you're playing blackjack and you kind of tap the table for another card. That's what you do to say thank you to someone. And obviously, for many things, there are many different legends of the provenance of things. But for this, the one that really appealed to me was that, you know, there was an emperor who really wanted to travel among his people. One of the things he was going to do was, you know, when he was at a restaurant with his entourage, he would, you know, also be like a regular person and just pour tea for people, which is completely, obviously, unheard of. And of course, they wanted to thank him. But they couldn't, you know, get off their chairs and bow down to thank him, because then everyone would know he's the emperor. So I guess that was the way they devised for them to thank him, which was to use their two fingers and tap the table. And the two fingers was kind of representative of them being on their bent knees and kind of bowing to him as to give their thanks.
That's such a beautiful description. And Audra, I was fascinated to learn And tell everybody, how has that Chinese term that means make tea, how has that come to stand for dissident?
Oh, it wasn't actually make tea. It's to drink tea, actually. The characters are slightly different. And so once in a while, you even get reporters who are asked to mm-hmm. have a cup of tea with authorities.
And that's the thing to be really afraid of right now.
Yeah,
huh?
Exactly.
If you're in China and somebody in a uniform says, let's have a cup of tea, run, right?
Exactly. And sometimes they're not even in uniform. They're like plain clothes. But yeah, you shouldn't run because that could be worse for you. But yeah, again, it depends, you know, on the situation and who you are. But I've heard foreign reporters, they actually do go to a tea house or, you know, meet somewhere and actually have a cup of tea. And then they'll kind of gently ask what you're doing and what stories you've been writing. And kind of it's a very semi-civilized form of interrogation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a Chinese dissident, a lot of times there's no tea. You know, you just kind of another way to say, you know, you're being taken in for a questioning. But generally, the drink a cup of tea thing is you do come back, you know, but it serves usually as a warning when you're doing something that the authorities aren't happy about. So they tell you what they would prefer you do over a cup of tea. Yeah.
Peking duck is also quite an ancient tradition. And you cite that it might date back to 400 A.D., but its real popularity actually came about 900 years later at the hands of a court physician and dietitian. So talk to us about that Peking duck. And what about stuffing the innards with sheep's stomach, cilantro, and scallions?
I know. That's pretty crazy. It's hard to tell if it was actually Peking duck in the form that we know it today, but there were references to roast duck that was mentioned in this book called The Principles of Correct Diet, or that's the translation written in 1330 by this court physician. And this whole tome was focused on nutrition and seasonal eating and hygiene. And it described this roast duck dish that was made by pulling out the innards of the duck before stuffing it with a mixture of sheep stomach, cilantro, scallions, and salt. And then the whole bird was speared on a fork and roasted over a charcoal fire. I'm assuming, you know, just from this, that, you know, it's something that would kind of have the balance of yin and yang, which is, or, you know, the heat and the nutrition that the Chinese culture is very much, you know, uses or talks about in its daily life.
Well, it's believed that Peking duck not only tastes delicious, but that it's medicinal as well. So what is it that the Peking duck is believed to do for you?
So the duck is supposed to be packed with protein, phosphorus, thiamine, iron, copper, zinc, and other trace elements, which the Chinese believe can help relieve a whole slew of ailments. And what I was talking about, the yin and yang, is kind of this concept. There are foods that are hot and there are foods that are cold. And so what you're trying to do is find a balance within your body of heat and cold. And so basically, the meat is considered quote-unquote cold. So it's supposed to, you know, clear out the lungs and nourish the blood and help with bruises and headaches and insomnia and coughs and fevers. So the things like cucumbers and scallions, they kind of fall into the cold category too.
Yes.
So that, you know, would help with things like sore throats and promotes digestion and prevents colds and nourish the skin. But honestly, I have to say today, I doubt people actually think of that. They just eat it because it's yummy.
Well, what is your absolute best food memory of eating this iconic Chinese dish when you were actually in China?
So it's very political, or, you know, like joking. I say this, you know, as a joke. That's why China sometimes reminds me of, you know, the culture in Singapore, too, where everyone has really, really strong feelings about where they think you could get the best chicken rice. You know, that's in Singapore, or, you know, whatever local dish there is. But in Beijing, at least, it's kind of the same thing. You ask someone, you know, where is the best Peking duck? You ask 24 people, you probably get, you know, 24 answers. Or if not 24, you know, the people who are in one camp will, like, thoroughly disagree with the people in the other camp. So my favorite place is a place called Liqun, which is spelled L-I-Q-U-N. You know, the duck is, the skin's crispy and it's crackling because a lot of the fat has been rendered out and the meat's like really moist. And Peking duck, you know, it's traditionally eaten. You slice the duck skin into slivers and then you don't eat the meat actually. Oh, actually, sometimes you do. You cut up the meat, but the main point is to eat the skin. And then it's accompanied by, again, it depends on where you are, but sometimes, you know, a lot of a sweet bean paste. It depends on what it is. But I personally, I like it with just a plain pancake. It's wrapped in a flour pancake with some skin, a little bit of sweet sauce, and cucumbers. That's the way I like it. It's very, very simple, but you can pretty much put anything you want in there.
Well, you're making me hungry, and I have to say that I was often hungry as I read your book, and I'm wondering, I've seen a lot of recipes for Peking duck, but do you know anybody who does it at home, or do you do it at home?
Oh, God, no. I would never, ever try doing it at home, and the whole process is pretty involved. If you want to eat really traditional Peking duck, you have to use a bicycle pump, for God's sake, you know, to separate the skin from the flesh. And actually, I think Mr. Lee, he actually, like, used his mouth. He actually blows, instead of a bicycle pump, he blows into a raw duck, you know.
Wow.
And again, nothing I would ever want to attempt.
So, wow.
No, and I don't know anyone who does that. I mean, it's so much easier and a lot more fun just to go to a place and get someone else to do the cooking and just pick out.
Our conversation with Audra Ong will continue after the break with a description of the authentic Chinese New Year experience in mainland China. Audra takes us along as all of China embarks on the requisite homecoming celebration, an event which results in the largest annual movement of people on the planet. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. As our conversation with Audra Ong, author of To the People, Food is Heaven, continues, Audra introduces us to her Beijing housekeeper, Cheng Aiyi. In China, Aiyi is an affectionate term, meaning auntie, a true description of the relationship which developed between the two women.
I don't even know where to begin about Cheng Aiyi. Cheng is her last name, and Aiyi is another way to say auntie. So I would just call her auntie sometimes. And she is a truly amazing woman, and she never understood why. I just thought she was so great. You know, maybe she's just like everyone else. But she was kind of like not quite a mom, but really kind of a de facto like aunt when I was there. She's very maternal, and she has this like, when she laughs, her whole face crinkles. And then I also saw another tender side where, you know, she obviously is a mother and she had to be separated from her children. And a couple times her kids were in Beijing because they were on school holidays. And I heard her teaching her daughter how to, like, hand wash clothes and stuff. So there were so many, I don't know. I mean, she's just great.
She sounds like such an amazing woman that she would travel hours to just get to work to clean houses. Would you please give us a glimpse of what it was like shopping in the markets with Cheng Aiyi?
Yeah, shopping in China, you have two different kinds of experiences. First, you can go to a supermarket, and that's more similar to the American experience, although, again, you know, the vegetables are different, and the volume of people is very different. But what's really fun for me that I love to do was to shop at the wet markets. And I went with Cheng Aiyi a couple times because I was going to have friends over for dinner, and I wanted her help with shopping. And so you get to a wet market, and it really is wet. You know, the floors are wet and everything. But the variety is just mind-boggling. You would have 54,000 kinds of greens and root vegetables, and your senses are assaulted by colors and smells and a variety of things. But not just vegetables. You have different kinds of meat. You have different cuts of pork. You literally have, like, a pig's face, you know, or all cuts of the pig. You have the tail, the legs, or the trotters, and, of course, the ribs and the loin, you know, everything. Like, you know, we eat head to tail. The Chinese people eat head to tail. So you go in there and just prepared to kind of lose yourself in the chaos. And shopping with Cheng Aiyi, you know, she knew the stalls that she liked. She would always go to those. But then if they didn't have things that were fresh enough for her, she would move on to the next one. She'd be really picky, you know, picking things, weighing them in her own hand, because sometimes the vendors would kind of wet the vegetables so that they're actually heavier when you weigh them. So she would actually ask them for the dry stuff in the back. She'd be like, you know, give me that one. This is too wet. It's too heavy. And then once the produce is good enough for her, then she'll ask about the price. And of course, again, you know, you always bargain. You never accept the first price that's given to you. But she would just, like, harass them. It's like, what, are you kidding me? How is this so expensive? What are you talking about? And, you know, her, she has this beautiful face. But then it would kind of grow kind of, like, harsh, you know, and kind of be like, I will not pay this price. And so, you know, the whole shopping experience from her, like, I learned so much, not just, you know, how to choose things, but just how to bargain, too. So that was my experience with her.
That sounds like an invaluable experience. When Americans think about food production in China, Audra, I think the first thing that comes to their mind is all the poisoning and horror stories. And so it really shocked me to read the other side of the coin, which, for one thing, said that China is second only to Australia in the amount of land set aside for organic farming. I hadn't really pictured it as a cradle of organic farming.
Yeah, and that, again, you know, is a figure I found while doing my research. But I think, you know, there have been huge strides made in the whole organic movement in China. But at the end of the day, it's still a really, really tiny portion of, well, there's two ways to look at it. In the consumer market, it's still a really tiny portion because, oddly enough, you know, Chinese people kind of like perfection, and organic food looks nothing like perfection. And so if you have, like, a hole-ridden leaf of vegetables, you know, or something like that, they don't really want to pay for that because they want things to look pretty. And things are also more expensive when it's organic. I mean, mm-hmm. like, it is here. And so while there is a growing market, it's still pretty small. But organic farming, in a way, has been around since the beginning of time for the Chinese people. I mean, farmers usually, they farm, and then they have their own plot where they eat from their land. And so they use, you know, the way they farm, they don't use pesticides on the food they eat. So in a way, in the countryside, they've been doing that. There's no shift because they never really shifted away from that as much.
The Chinese countryside was a whole fascinating topic, and it shocked me that something that's really relatively new in Europe, and it's just kind of now getting a foothold in the United States, appears to have been thriving in China since the 1970s, what I think is commonly referred to as agritourism. Talk to us about that movement there.
Nowadays, you know, this thing called Nongjiale, which there are many translations, but it's kind of like happy country home is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers are trying to get in on the boom that, you know, the cities have felt, you know. And so one of the ways they're doing it is opening up their homes.
For visitors, yeah.
Yeah, for visitors, you know, so that they can stay in, you know, a quote-unquote real farm home for a night and have a real farm meal. And
well, describe for us your experience with Farmer Sun and his happy country home.
Oh, Farmer Sun. I feel like I'm idealizing a lot of this, but you know, when you leave a place, you remember the good times, and even if it's a little more polished than it really was, you know, those are the things that are going to stay with me for a long time, and Farmer Sun's place was one of them. And, you know, we get there, and it's like the road to get there, it's like the usual bad traffic and smog, and then it's in the mountains. We get in the mountains, and slowly, you know, the city kind of, like, disappears into our rearview mirror, and the air is fresher, and it's greener, and finally, we get to Farmerson's home, and the first thing I notice after the driver turns off the engine is, you know, silence. I hear chicken in the distance, you know, that kind of thing. And it's like, oh, my God. And we get there, and Farmerson is this, like, tall, rangy man with kind of big ears and the biggest smile you've ever seen. And he's like, hello. It was just such a welcome change from the city. And I was about to leave Beijing at the time, so I was just kind of sad. And I was there with some friends, and it was just nice to have this wonderful, quiet weekend away. But, of course, for me, the best part was the food. And Farmer Sun and his wife, they cook everything from their backyard. Everything is from there. I think they buy maybe, they don't have pigs, so maybe they would buy pork from the store or the market, you know, but that's about it. And so, you know, I don't remember, I mean, I remember some of the stuff they cook, but for me, it will always be about the omelet. And this omelet, again, I don't describe it. It's like Cheng Ai's chicken wings. I don't know what makes it so perfect, but it's this, like, you know what it is? I think it's because they cook it in a wok. And in Chinese cooking, the wok just imparts this intangible smokiness to the food that mm-hmm. you can't get in a regular American pan. Maybe the closest thing is a cast iron skillet, maybe, but you know, the walk itself, you can talk a whole afternoon about it.
Well, one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you, aside from the fact that I'm a great fan of the book, is that the Chinese New Year occurs this year on February 10th. Would you explain the importance of this holiday in China?
So Chinese New Year is China's biggest and most celebrated holiday. I think it's actually 15 days long, and it depends on what day. You eat different things on different days. Chinese New Year Eve, you usually have something called a reunion dinner. Everyone sits around a table, and this is when you break out the best of the best. You have the most luxurious food you can afford. But on another day, you make dumplings, and that's where everyone sits around. You make homemade dumplings. And then another day, you have the glutinous rice ball in a soup, which is more dessert that's stuffed with, like, peanuts or black sesame or red bean paste. And so different days, you have different kinds of food. And it's generally, you know, it's to usher in the new year. And you have lion dances, and it's just one giant celebration, and a lot of it is centered around food.
And this really is the big holiday in China, right?
Yeah, it's the biggest day. I mean, it's also like you have the longest. You don't actually get 15 days off, but, you know, usually you have about a week off. That's, you know, when usually everyone travels. And again, since it's a big celebration, it is the holiday.
Well, that was one of the things, you know, you're talking about New Year's Eve being the reunion meal. And so I guess that's because virtually everybody travels home to their birthplace to be with their families. And you describe this as the largest annual movement of humans on the planet. So what is it like to be in China during the midst of all this moving about and heading home?
Oh, God. Okay, so the first rule for me was that you never travel during Chinese New Year. I mean, if I did, I would usually travel outside of China. But now, you know, because a lot of Chinese are becoming a lot more wealthy, I mean, everyone kind of travels outside too. But it's really, really insane. I mean, airport, the lines are crazy. Everything's packed. Ticket prices are crazy. There's a certain period where they start selling tickets for Chinese New Year. And so people will line up at the train station, you know. It's like camping out for football season tickets or something. Or, you know, for Black Friday when people camp out at Best Buy. You know, it's the same thing. You know, you camp out for train tickets.
Well, I guess that really is an illustration of the importance of the family in China.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's very, very family-oriented. Yeah, it is. It does.
Audra, what do you perceive the future of China to be?
Your guess is as good as mine, honestly. I mean, I can't say that I have or will ever truly understand China. So much of it is because, you know, there isn't much transparency, but you just never know what's going to happen. And, I mean, politically, it's hard to say, but I would hope that they would open up a little, but I'm not sure. I doubt that it will ever be, you know, a democratic society like in the U.S., although I'm sure that's debatable. But I don't think it will ever get there. But I think if they're going to open up economically, they have to somehow become a little more free politically. But I don't know what direction that's going to go in.
Well, I want to thank you so much for giving us this glimpse into the China of today. So thank you for taking the time to visit with us on Louisiana Eats.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and for being so open to learn, you know, all these things. It's just wonderful. And I had a great conversation with you. Thank you.
Audra Ng, author of the new book, To the People, Food is Heaven.
I went to Chinatown, way back in old Hong Kong, to get some egg foo young. And then I heard a gong. Ling ting tong, got to sing that song. I smoke a boom, die, I smoke a boom.
Public radio contributor and freelance journalist Ian McNulty is the author of Louisiana Rambles, an off-the-beaten-path exploration of our state's heartland. As Louisiana Eats rambling reporter, Ian's here to take us on another food journey. Ian, where you been rambling lately?
Hi, Poppy. Well, today we're headed to Vacherie. Probably know it's a town in St. James Parish on the west bank of the river, not too far from New Orleans, kind of like halfway between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. Now, downtown Vacherie is sort of short on sights. You know, it's not not the thriving metropolis that maybe it once was, but it does have some really good food. And one of the places to go for that is Spuddy's Cajun Foods. When you walk into this place, it kind of looks like a downtown lunchroom, almost like a diner. Wood paneling, you sit in folding chairs, big tables, little things of crackers and hot sauce on the table. It's kind of a neat place, though. All around the room are murals and these old photos that kind of tell the tale of local history from, like, old floods or hunting trips, pictures of downtown. On the menu, which is what we're really interested in, of course, you know, normal kind of diner food. You can get a burger there, including those full-pound burgers, this big monster burger. But what you're really coming here for is the andouille sausage. This is that big, smoky, chunky, peppery River Parish's style andouille that I personally just love.
The kind that you can see the chunks of meat in it.
Absolutely, yeah. They make it right here at the shop, too. So this is like, you know, handmade right there andouille. And it turns up all over the menu. Of course, it's in the gumbo, the chicken sausage gumbo. Also in po'boys and even in salads. Have you ever had an andouille sausage salad, Poppy?
No, but that's exactly what I would suspect you could find in Louisiana.
That's right. That's right. Now, this isn't like your sort of let's go on a diet kind of salad. You probably won't be surprised to hear. Mostly iceberg, lettuce, some boiled eggs, a couple tomatoes here and there. Of course, some shredded cheddar. And then these red coins of sausage that have been kind of crisped up on the griddle. Really nice.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, this is just a perfect example of the lengths that we have to go to in Louisiana to get people to eat their greens.
That's right. That's right. Or in the case of iceberg, sort of their off-whites. But some other things here. Okay, so Spuddy's is the name of this restaurant we're talking about. Now, they do have loaded baked potatoes, you know, which, of course, completely crammed with shrimp and crab and just good stuff like that. This is the kind of place, you know, you order one of these plates at Spuddy's and the table fills up with all the little side dishes that come with it, you know, your corn, your slaw, your potatoes. But of course, you know, for me at Spuddy's, it all comes back to that andouille. You know, they make it in the house. If you pull around the back of Spuddy's, you can even see the smokehouse, you know, with the wood piled up all around it. It doesn't look like much, just kind of looks like a shed back there. But if the wind's blowing the right way, you know what they're up to in there. It's just beautiful Louisiana andouille.
There's some magic going on in that Definitely. Shack back there.
Definitely.
So is it lunch only?
Yeah. Yeah, it's mainly lunch. And if you do stop by, they have a big, you know, cooler up front where you can grab some links to go and whatever other smokehouse products they're making.
Well, thank you so much for telling us about another hidden treasure in our beautiful state of Louisiana. Thank you, Ian.
Oh, my pleasure, Poppy.
Louisiana Eats rambling reporter, Ian McNulty. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we'll prepare for the carnival with a carnivore's delight as the team from Cleaver & Company gives us a look at the burgeoning national movement of snout-to-tail butchery.
People are really interested. Like, they get really excited when they're like, oh, heart, I've been looking for beef heart and I didn't know where to find it. Or there's this one guy that comes in that buys pork heart all the time. But, you know, at first we were kind of, you know, concern was that people are so used to going to the store and buying a ribeye or a tenderloin. So they come in, they're like, you're out of ribeye and you're out of tenderloin. But we have so many other options that we can offer them. Like, I had a woman came in yesterday and was like, okay, what do I want for dinner?
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.